Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Now entering the DGTC.
Are you ready for a deep dive?
And Jordan did most of the crap.
Can't believe I said that.
I've been doing this since 2008. What the fuck do I know?
Drawing hands is like kryptonite.
Dark loading up elbow logos.
Yeah. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the DGDC, a united team of design professionals creatively bound to bring unique inspiration and uncommon perspectives. You can email us listener questions or topic ideas to hello@dgdcpod.com or check out our website, dgdcpod.com, and don't forget to follow us on Instagram or Twitter @dgdcpod. Plus now you can join in on the conversation. We have a Facebook group. Just pop onto our website and hit the community tab at the top. Now, on with the show. Hey guys, wanted to let you know that this episode is brought to you by our friends at Skillshare. With so many different amazing and important conversations happening throughout the world right now, it's really important that your voice is as essential as ever. And the way to do that is to explore classes throughout the Skillshare library. That helps you express what you're feeling through creative self-discovery, or if you're just looking for something cool and new to expand your creative offerings. Right now, the one we wanted to talk a little bit about was by Paula Scherer. You all know her from Pentagram. She has a terrific course called Dynamic Brand Identity, Designing Logos That Evolve. And she's going to take you through what she calls her liquid identity. It's like a recognizable dynamic branding system that can be adapted across all different kinds of mediums. It's a 70-minute class, and she goes through all the great stuff as far as their introduction, a really great kind of thing about all her research, finding solutions, and how she simplifies down her logo process. The cool thing is you actually go through the whole process with her, and she's going to show you some terrific ones and examples from her past, like Jazz at Lincoln Center or the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Skillshare offers memberships with meaning, so much to explore, real projects to create, and Skillshare empowers you to accomplish real growth. Members get unlimited access to all of the thousands of inspiring classes on there. All of them are hands-on, all of them offer feedback, and you have a community of millions to work with. So there are no ads, and there is everything to learn. It's basically about $10 a month for an annual subscription. So what are we offering for you again? Well, explore all this creativity at Skillshare.com/deepend2. And the first 1,000 of our listeners, people like you who use that link, will get a free trial of the Skillshare Premium membership. Receive free access to thousands of classes for a limited time. Be one of the first of the DGDC listeners of 1,000 to sign up at Skillshare.com/deepend2. All right, guys. Well, welcome back. It is November. What is going on with this year?
I know, man.
I know. Thanksgiving is around the corner, basically.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's weird.
Oh, my gosh.
We already started compiling our list of grocery items because you don't want to be the last to, like, order
exactly.
them from groceries online or get there to...
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever been there, though, where you're walking through the grocery store maybe 3 days prior to the holiday and there's one, what is the Butterball brand? Is that
uh-huh.
the popular?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's just one lonely frozen turkey just sitting there. It's like, oh, fuck, I got to take that one, I guess.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Have you gotten yours already? Does that
no.
happen, though? Yeah, I
no.
don't even. The vegetarian no. doesn't know. I'm just looking for my tofurkey box that's at Whole Foods. And I'll bring
well,
that to the family.
I love a good traditional Thanksgiving, but I love doing something out of the box, though, too. Mm-hmm. We did Cornish Game Hens not too long ago, and it was amazing. Like,
yeah.
Jason cooked up something beautiful with that. I like going a little awesome. off the rail.
Yeah, I think we're forgoing the turkey this year in favor of something else.
It's all about the sides anyway, right, Jordan?
Oh, God. Love that. Brussels sprouts are back.
Yes.
I love that.
Yes. Mm.
God, sweet potatoes.
I know.
Oh my God.
All those roasted veggies are the best.
we've had, our family tradition has been that we always have someone makes lasagna. That it just like.
Oh my gosh, you guys are so Italian.
It's so Italian. Yeah. I love it. And what's funny is when my mom was still with us, she used to make it and she'd make it specifically for me because I didn't like cheese when I was a kid. And she made it with jam packed full of meatballs. And here I am, the one that turned out to be vegetarian at the end. So now I'm like, bring on the cheese.
Is there no other vegetarian in your core family?
Not many, no. Everybody's starting to get a little more conscious.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot more people, you know, that are having less, and that's great. But I just love it because it's like carbo load day for me because it's nothing but sides.
Yeah, totally.
And it's just the best. So I love it. How's everybody else doing otherwise? What kind of anything interesting new work-wise or – settling down for the holidays? What's going down?
We have a new account that is I'm losing sleep over this one, I have to be honest.
Really?
It's like over my head. It's so intimidating.
Those are the best though, right?
I know. It makes your brain tick. It is true. I am grateful for that.
Good.
But I'm leading the project with other team members, and so there's just a little bit more of that pressure to wow.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it's fintech. It's in the land of AI and fintech. So of course I'm just my brain's getting stretched in a good way. But you know what? If it weren't for being a consultant in this fashion, we would lose sight of that. It's a really amazing perk to be able to have these discovery phases where you otherwise wouldn't be able to be aware or learn these areas otherwise. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's where you learned. I think when you stretch your boundaries on your own, God, the next time you go into it so much more confident when the next big challenge comes.
That's where I should be that's where I should be because I already have this referral came from an AI company that we supported a couple years ago. So I should be there, but I'm like, it's just who I am. Like, and I think that's a good thing. You should never be totally comfortable, right?
No, I'd never want to be.
Yeah. You got a challenge. That's how you grow.
You got a challenge.
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Jordan? What's new with you?
Dude, for some reason, it's been the busiest year I've had. And
so
at least
crazy.
Around this season, it is nuts. And I'm still just like, I don't know whether it's COVID or just quarantine, but
I was just
going to
say, is
stop.
That ramifications of pandemic? Like, what is going on?
It's either that or it's just like, I'm too scared not to take on the work. I don't know what it is, right? Just the fear.
Because you don't
that
know.
Underline.
Because I know you're not saying no to a lot right now, are you? You're
no,
just like,
but the opportunities are still kind of there. It's funny,
the
work I'm getting is definitely pivoted in favor of like companies that are doing better during the pandemic. Like I'm doing a lot of like video game stuff, which my video game knowledge really lands in like the Super Nintendo era. I'm not a huge gamer, but
interesting. That's cool though.
But there's been a lot of opportunity there, which is super fun. Yeah.
How did that connection come about for you?
So there's a bunch of like agencies here in Portland, and I've contracted with a couple of them that like do stuff exclusively for like Xbox or these video games that are kind of around here. And so just through networking and working with these teams, give me some opportunity to partner up, which is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, super fun.
That's really, really wonderful. And isn't it speak to the location that you're at too? I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I know remote, you can kind of work anywhere. And I think definitely COVID's proven that. But I will say, like, you know, a lot of my biggest connections have come through local in some form, you know.
You know what? This was years ago, but Nick, it might have been when you stepped on in the early phase. We had some listener questions that were along the lines of, I live on 20 acres. Like, it's not a metropolitan area. How do I obtain work? What do you suggest? And there is something to say something that speaks to that. I mean, it is interesting to have those local connections. Especially if you've been in a creative agency and you've maintained those connections, you haven't burnt any bridges, like you just never know. Like over 10 years span, what can happen from that?
Yeah, I think I mean, my dream is to, like, you know, maybe move outside of the city. Like, we're in downtown inner Portland. But I think to get started, it does make it kind of easier. And I don't know why that is. I think, yeah, for sort of making those connections, it feels easier when, at least for me, it's easier to land a local job. If I say, hey, I'm here in Portland, you know, most people, I think, are opted to hire someone local. Maybe it's because they think they're in the same mindset or there's just some weird unspoken camaraderie together. But, you know, I do find that local work is easier for me to land for the most part.
It's just, I think there's just a certain kind of like comfort level in approach, if they've approached you or whatever, you feel like there's a, you got, oh, well, there's one thing in my checkbox. I'm local to them.
For sure.
And actually that confidence is great.
Like,
what about you, Nick? What's going on?
Every client is like so on board with, like, I've never seen them more proactive about what 2021 is going to look like. Like I think one silver lining for them is the fact that they are looking at the next year and planning much more efficiently, much more strategically. And I love that. Like, three of them came to me in the same week with like, can we go over plans for the next year? And I was like, wow, what a trip for them all to do that.
I would say that that's a ramification of pandemic too.
I mean, if you have to be more efficient as a business right now. Like, you just have to be able to, like, where's the fat? Where am I cutting it? I'm noticing that same sort of mentality, which is fantastic as a designer. It's like, let's plan months ahead. Let's not try to start a project that's due in 2 weeks, you know?
I love that. That it has made a big difference in just the way I'm attacking things. I feel like last week was a great week to have with all three of them, to have that week of discovery and actually work and look and research and look at competitors, get great inspiration and stuff. I just don't feel like I've had that chance over the last maybe 8 months because it was so, like, need it tomorrow. And again, that's another thing. Like, you got to be poised for both ways, right? You
got to know. I just have a topic idea.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
Because I, whenever make a something, note. Yes. I, what, doesn't this happen all the time and you accommodate, right? Oh, yeah. You know, and everybody in marketing is the mercy of sales or somebody else. Like, there's always a chain, right? Well, come on. At the end of the day, we're trying to manage all these projects and accounts that we have on our plate. So do you charge a rush fee? Have you implemented that? Is it appropriate? How much is appropriate? If for longstanding accounts, at what point do you, you know, bring that up altogether?
True. Yeah. And I've had that conversation with a lot of younger designers who are in that role, and they got a few rush jobs. They didn't know what to do. And you're right. Maybe that's a great one to cover, because I think, even though I'm seasoned with it, when it comes to me sometimes, it might be some different arrangement or something different, and it's so quick, but it's still a very robust project. So you're like, I got to make the best out of this for myself too, before I say yes too. And then how do you communicate that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, I know there's pricing episodes everywhere, but I do think, like, it's so situational that I think it can be broken down in so much further, right? Like, what do you do if they only need, you know, 20 minutes of work? Like, do you charge by the hour? Do you charge by half? Or, like, if it's repeating or, like, sort of retaining client that only needs 20 minutes every week or whatever, like, update shit? I don't know. Like, what do you do? And those are those situational things that it can get real dense.
I think it will be just an outwardly thoughtful episode to, because I've never put it into action, but I think it's time.
Yeah. Perfect. It's on the list.
Yeah. All the ways you can price, man. Because I price out stuff different for every project.
Every time. Yeah.
It's not always value-based. It's not always hourly. Like,
no,
it's
I'm with you. I'm with
situational.
Yeah. Totally. We can tuck that in our pockets.
Yeah. Good. We got it. I love it. Well, we want to tell you a little bit about today's interview and today's guest. Mikkel, do you want to give them a little bit of a intro as to who we got to speak to?
Sure. Well, this interview was just one word that comes to mind is special. I mean, she's a gem to me. I mean, she's just genuine and she speaks from the heart. And before we had her, the three of us talked about knowing that her mom had passed when the pandemic was new and that it might be a sensitive topic. Make sure, don't go out of your way to dodge, but just try to organically allow it or don't bring it up yourself. And she brought it up, and I thought that was gorgeous that she did. And it was just, you know, not a side note, but something that she kind of took a big breath as she was explaining. And it just speaks to her personality, the warmth of her storytelling, her experience as a designer. Her mom was a designer. This is a part of her upbringing. It's really kind of an emotional episode to me. Yeah. And in that regard, and she has experienced a dip with respect to the pandemic and sought a way to pull out a great story from that with a hobby and a fabulous following and some wonderful respect through her Instagram account and otherwise. So it's just a beautiful episode inside and out.
Yeah.
I've listened to it a couple of times.
Oh, that's cool. I know. I re-listened to it again. We should say it's with a friend of ours, Annie Atkins. She was in Dublin, I believe, when we talked to her, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. And what a story. I don't think I've had interviewed someone where I was taking more notes of like just great little advice and things that she said. And it wasn't even the typical tips. It was these things of just ways of thinking or how to reposition yourself as a potential person that someone would hire for projects and things like that, or how to think differently on who to go after as a job, and her confidence, yet no ego. I loved that about her. Right. Yeah.
That's very, very important that you brought that up.
Like, par for the course for what she does. And if anyone doesn't know, one, you should stop and just go and look at her work, because it's outstanding stuff. But she does a lot of stuff for film. She does like background or prop work and
graphic design for film. Design, I think that was right.
Like, she did a bunch of stuff with Wes Anderson and Spielberg.
And, you know, think about how long we've been in this creative industry. And it just didn't occur to me that there was a full on.
Yeah.
Niche that went toward all of this. I mean, it made me feel a little bit dumbfounded.
And that's the thing where it's like, Nick, when you mentioned like the ego check, where she doesn't have one, because I think in that line of work, you can't. Like, your stuff is meant to blend into the background and not be, but without it, you don't have a scene, you don't have a location, you don't have a setting and a world. She creates the world that these people act in. So like, what a treat to get to like to talk to someone. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. And she's not in Hollywood too. That's the I think that's her. That's like the best thing she's got going for her, because she says it. She says it so nonchalantly about what she gets to work on and do. I remember the only time this had ever been a thought to me was when I used to watch Mad Men, and you'd see all the props and the things in the background. You're like, that wasn't just found objects. Someone had to go and recreate and make design. What was graphic design and packaging and signage and
think
branding?
About how we might just take for granted easily how much discovery and inspiration and referencing and research we do with our online sources. She cannot do that.
Oh God. Exactly. And
she
gives us like a lot of great, one of my favorite questions was, and you'll see what she says, was, where do you get your inspiration from? And she has some nuggets that you should be writing down as well, as far as when you want to go and look for particular things from periods of time or genres of design. So we should probably just shut up and play this interview, because I think the three of us can go on forever talking about Annie. So yeah, we really hope you enjoy this. This is our interview with Annie Atkins.
All right, and this is just super exciting, because we've got Annie Atkins as our special guest here with us today. And this is, I mean, this is really quite extraordinary how quickly we were able to book this, given that it's an international guest we have.
Come
with
on.
Us. Annie is based out of Dublin. It's so nice to have you with us, Annie.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be here.
So Annie is known for her creative artworks in the filmmaking space, you may know, and both imaginary, such as The Box Trolls, which is incredibly creative animated production, and then true story non-fictional based, such as Bridge of Spies film from 2015 starring Hanks Mann.
Damn.
So, and although this particular talk of Annie's was from 2017, I strongly encourage our listeners to quote-unquote attend The Secret World of Graphic Design for Filmmaking on YouTube or something similar. It's fascinating. That was really, really, really well done. And I would argue that for most of us as creatives, we strive to be noticed in one way or another. And in fact, this can dip into a huge discussion regarding social media and so forth, which Nick, Jordan, and I believe can just get so stinking out of hand these days. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because I suppose in an unordinary sense, Annie's work is not really supposed to be entirely noticed in film production pieces. So do you feel, Annie, like you had to kind of warm up to that reality of your niche, so to speak? I mean, before your work became known by the world, was it difficult to swallow that, for example, signage pieces blurred in the background at a subway station didn't achieve recognition, you know?
Hours of work.
Right.
Well, I once heard an art director in filmmaking describe graphic props as being all the things that everybody sees but nobody gives a shit about. And I remember reading that, he tweeted it, and I remember reading that and thinking, oh yeah, that's really accurate actually.
I mean, was it like, that's for me? Like, that sounds amazing. Like,
yeah,
it's such a... Well, I suppose the thing with graphics in film is that if you're working on a very realistic drama, which most filmmaking wants to be, I suppose, then you really shouldn't notice the graphics. Like, people only usually notice this stuff when it's wrong, because graphic design usually has some kind of text or lettering in it. It's human nature that we want to read the things we see in the background, whether that's shopfront signage or, I don't know, a poster warning of like a deadly disease, or even if it's just something like a door number, you always read that lettering, right?
Yeah.
So I think graphic designers can get away with far fewer mistakes on a film set than other areas of the art department might. Like, if a table leg isn't quite the right period for the setting, it'll probably go unnoticed. But if you use, you know, if you use Helvetica in a film set in the 1940s, forget about it.
Yeah.
You're going straight to the IMDb goofs page.
That is amazing. I love the ones you shared. It's so hilarious.
Me too. At any given point, do you find yourself a little bit obsessively checking that?
Oh, I do check it. I check it a lot, actually. You know, not because I have a kind of a beef with people who are like posting my mistakes online. I actually find it quite educational because
there are so nice.
Well, there are so many things that I just wouldn't think about. Like when I was on Bridge of Spies, which was Spielberg's Cold War thriller. So it's a true story, and he wanted everything to be like super realistic, you know, so the audience knew they were in a real time and place. I had to draw up the flags, the American Stars and Stripes flags, for a courtroom scene, I think. And the film was set in 1957, but I drew... Hang on, let me get this right now. I drew the flags as having 50 stars.
Oh,
you forgot Hawaii and Alaska.
So this is before Hawaii and Alaska were states.
Right,
so
right.
The flag should have had 48 stars. And if you're an American graphic designer, you probably just know this without even thinking about it. But it just didn't occur to me.
I'm sure
you're
giving
us a lot of
credit. Completely messed that one up. Wow.
So that got catalogued on the IMDb goofs page. And when I didn't even know until I read that. I mean, I watched the movie and didn't notice.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be an education.
Yeah.
Source, see it yourself when the movie comes out. And you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Sometimes, I mean... Once the movie is out, it doesn't really matter. Like, it's fine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's done. hopefully everybody's concentrating on the drama unfolding between the characters and the great plot, you know? The worst thing is when you're halfway through shooting a film and you've made a mistake and it's an expensive mistake to correct, but it has to be corrected before filming ends. That's the worst.
Yeah, exactly. That's fair. Yeah.
You talked about the boxes from the Budapest.
Yeah.
Right? And there was a and tell the story, because I think it's hilarious how it came to how you found out about it.
Just a great introduction. Like, welcome, Annie. Let's talk about all the mistakes you've made in your design career. Thank you so much for coming on.
Totally up to you. We can just slide into all the successes right now if we want to.
Well, the Mendel's patisserie box, the pink patisserie box from the Grand Budapest Hotel, is probably my biggest mistake in a film. But it's also like one of the most beloved movie props I've ever made. So
yeah,
you know,
they're so iconic,
it's fine.
Right?
We did correct the mistake before the movie was released. But I put a spelling mistake on the box, so it has the word patisserie on the box, and everything we did for the film was pretty much everything was hand lettered, so it never went through a digital spell check.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it's a word of French origin. I should have double-checked it, triple-checked it. I didn't. And about halfway through the shoot, I suppose, a little bit more even maybe, Wes Anderson contacted me and said, I think there's a spelling mistake on the Mendel's box. And I'm like, I really take a lot of pride in my spelling and grammar, you know. So I was very much like, I don't think so. I take a lot of pride in my spelling and grammar.
Hold on there.
But he was right, of course. I put two T's in patisserie. It should be one T and two S's.
And that's a tough word.
And then two S's.
That's,
yeah.
Yeah. I feel
We had to correct that in post-production, which can be really time-consuming, especially because that prop appears in so many sets in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like zoom shots and tracking shots on it, so it was quite a job. But you know, we fixed it, we changed it, and then afterwards, after the movie was released, that box kind of became a bit of an icon for the film.
Yeah.
And people started selling fakes on eBay they'd made themselves, I suppose. But I always knew if it didn't have the spelling mistake in it, then it wasn't.
It was
oh,
fake.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then
that's your certificate of authenticity.
Yeah, exactly. And then some years later, somebody called me. They found my phone number online and they called me from an auction and said that there was one for sale, and they just wanted to check if the story was true, because this box did have the spelling mistake, and they wanted to buy it. And I think they bought it for like $500 or something.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That's fantastic.
Wow.
Because you made thousands of them, right? Like there were that one scene.
Yeah, we made, I can't remember the exact number that we made, but it was certainly hundreds anyway, because there was one scene. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the scene where Zero and Agatha, they kind of fall into mm-hmm. a big pile
yes.
of them?
Yes. Yeah, just surrounded by these things.
Yes.
Yeah.
We had to have lots of repeats. Extras,
a pink mountain.
You know?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a great set, that one. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because, like, and this is putting it through the perspective of, I do a lot of like branding and logo design, and usually this work, it's like we create something, it has hyper focus on it, and then it kind of continuously lives and adapts and just like goes on. But your work, I imagine, like, you just spend so much time and effort in trying to figure out logistics and making something happen, bringing it to life, shoot it, and then it kind of just lives in the film. And then what happened? Like, where does all this stuff go? Is it sentimentalized, or is it just like, we did.
Does it all go for sale like that one piece?
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Big storage unit?
Because you must have created a lot of pieces.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I look at like all my pieces. I'm like, yeah, these are cool. I can see where they live and they.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things just get thrown away, to be honest. It's different on a Wes Anderson film. On a Wes Anderson film, everything gets archived and taken to an archive somewhere. So that's great, you know, everything's saved somewhere. But usually, like any TV series I work on, or most of the movies I work on, things just end up in a skip because people don't have the storage space, and especially with graphic props that generally are made out of paper, so they age very easily. Like, it's very hot on sets, the actors' hands are very sweaty.
Yes.
Like, any love letter or little note or anything is just going to get so degraded that you couldn't use it again on another film anyway.
Yeah.
I think some set decorators keep things. When I was talking to the set decorator from, do you remember the Tom Hanks movie Big?
Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. Of course.
Love.
Yeah, I know. It's like one of my favorite films. And yeah. I was speaking to the set decorator and he had kept so many pieces from that film. And I was really interested in the, do you remember Zoltar? The arcade machine.
Yeah.
Who grants his wish.
Yes.
Yeah. So he kind of grants his wish and then he spits out a little ticket, a little token at the bottom of the machine. It's just a card that says your wish is granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was just really curious about that, about who had made it, you know, because it was kind of, the film is from a time before graphic designers were hired specifically for a film set. And the set decorator didn't know. He couldn't remember. Nobody that I spoke to on the film could remember. But he had kept a copy of it in his basement for the last...
Oh, my goodness.
For the last, what, is it 40 years, maybe?
Easy. 30 years at least, right?
30 years, yeah, maybe, yeah.
And yeah. I think my first question I was thinking of to ask you was, we all struggle with budget and expectation of, like, particularly whoever's in charge or whoever has the wallet. How do you manage expectations of the creativity always winning, but the budget of... I don't even know where you even start. We at least have models to know what a budget of a project we're working on, but you're dealing with such hypothesis of things. How do you deal with that?
I will say that graphic design for a film is generally not very expensive, you know, compared to other areas of filmmaking. Like, it's not like hiring a helicopter or an animal handler for the day, you know. It's mostly bits of paper that I print myself on my desktop printer. So if something comes up that is a bit of a spend, you speak to the art director about it, and they usually find a way to get the money if it's really necessary. I think the most expensive set piece I've ever made was a fake marble floor for the TV series Penny Dreadful.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, like in the olden days, that would have been a painter's job. So the scenic painters would have painted an MDF floor or whatever to look like it was marble.
Yeah.
But now it's moving more and more over to digital artwork, which is the graphic designer's realm. So I think that one floor cost us like €40,000 or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And then you did the theater marquee. I think that was for Penny Dreadful as well, right? Where do you like? I could design anything, but do you have a limitation to know, like, don't go over this line because of the budget or maybe the timing? I mean,
like where timing the parameters on sit.
Do you mean with respect to the detail?
Yeah, like how? Yeah, because it looks like you have multiple stained glass and you have like all those sections. Like I look at it so like strategic. Like, okay, how much is this going to cost? Do you get to maybe just design freely and show the comp and then let them figure it out? Or what's the process like?
Well, I usually start with a concept drawing and then that concept drawing gets shown to the production designer and the art directors and the director as well. And if it feels like it's worth it, then they usually
green
put
light.
Some money to green light it. I mean, I'm trying to think of something that hasn't been greenlit because it was too expensive. I suppose I make a lot of fake letterpress things, and I usually make them digitally. The only time I've really letterpressed something was for the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Okay, so
there are those kind of constraints, yeah. I suppose.
Are you? I mean, I want to get to the fake love letters. But first, I did just randomly think to myself, I wonder what are most minimal looking piece of art for filmmaking you've ever created to date might be. And I'm saying looking, which is not to say that it might be a piece that required the least amount of work. You know what I mean? Like you may have put a fair amount of
the most subtle,
but people that aren't in the creative space look at that and think, oh, it's pretty minimal and simplistic, you know?
Yeah. I think most of the props I make are like that. They look so simple. Like, I mean, when I give a talk or a presentation or we exhibit things, you know, of course I show like the beautiful pink chocolate boxes or the
marquee.
Beautiful old stained glass marquee. Yeah. But that's only like a really small percentage of the work we make for a movie. Like most of the stuff I make is like piles of very boring legal documents on the desk of a solicitor, or a notice board in the background that needs some like lost cat posters on it, or like, you know, telephone numbers or scraps of things.
Yeah.
And there's no direction for any of this, you know. You kind of have to come up with it yourself, and these are generally pretty boring pieces. Lots of like little handwritten things,
normal things that would be in this anyone's settings, really, right? Like,
yeah,
the things that would be on your random desk, whoever you are.
Yeah, and these things are not cataloged, so if you need to design a beautiful chocolate box label, that's fine, because you have like got thousands and thousands of references for historical artifacts for this piece. But if you want to design a notice board for a doctor's surgery corridor in the 1950s, like, nobody's archived this. So I find a good way to go about researching that kind of thing is to go to a real contemporary doctor's surgery and photograph the real notice board in the hallway, and then also research 1950s printing techniques and try and marry the two.
It's so immersive. I mean, I think that's maybe something where, like, a simple piece of paper, right, like a surgeon's notes or something, is like, oh yeah, that's in the background, maybe it's out of focus. But like, the amount of thought that you have to get in, you know, like, you have to put yourself into that mindset of like, if I'm a doctor in the 50s, like, what kind of fonts are we using here? I got to figure out what fonts are available then, or how the printing works,
printing,
like,
okay, process, right?
Yeah, it's not just coming out of an inkjet or something. So like, I gotta you know, and like, even the paper is a little different back then, or like, is it, you know? So like, the, I just like the story that you create of something as simple as a background prop, because you're putting yourself, it's so immersive, right? And as creatives, especially even listeners who are like, are designers, like, if I'm going to design a wine logo, I have to become sort of like immersed in that world of like, okay, what am I, I'm a winemaker, I'm like on a vineyard, what am I seeing, what am I smelling,
sure,
how am I going to incorporate this into the story?
Yeah, you,
because everything
it
really boils down to that. And I think there's something really, really cool about that much, you know, sort of environmental immersion into something as simple as a piece of paper. I mean, I think that's, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you really do have to immerse yourself in research from a certain period, because the worst thing you can do is just try to imagine what you think it would look like.
Yeah.
Because it's almost always completely the opposite. Or
it'd be a mistake, yeah.
It's a mistake. It's also, you know, it's never really quite as interesting as it actually was back in the day. We make so many assumptions about what things looked like. It's like the old thing of everything being sepia toned. You know, I often work on a period show, and the director and the producers, they want everything to have a kind of muted look, because that's what we're used to seeing in old sepia tinted photographs from the past. You know, and I think that's one of the things that was such a joy to work with Wes Anderson because he uses so much color, and he takes those little anomalies from history and he really builds on them. Whereas a lot of the time, if I do a period TV show, like, we're going for that muted look, and it's just not true. I mean, the Victorians loved color.
And it wasn't muted and faded back in the day.
It's
muted and faded now, which shows what are your levels of research?
It has to be insane.
Extraordinary. And I think this would be where a lot of our listeners, a lot of the Max attendees would probably gain a lot from you, is where do you dig? How do you, have you found anything that is so super resourceful that you can share that would be a great tip for period, style, vibe?
Best tip for finding pieces of research material is probably the Library of Congress website.
Ooh.
In the States. They have such a great archive, and they're also really good with legal clearance, which is really important in filmmaking. We can often apply for permission to use actual historical pieces and reproduce them. So they're a great resource. I often go to museums and galleries. Like, when I worked on a TV show about the Titanic, I ended up flying to Glasgow to their archive at the university there to look at their old ship drawings. I mean, I use the internet as well, of course, but it can be tricky. Like, you know, Google image search, it shouldn't really be like the last port of call, because
good call,
it can be a bit of a wild goose chase, and sites like Pinterest and things like that are great for gathering bits of inspiration, but nothing is really catalogued properly. So it's very difficult to know what the size of something was or the texture of the paper.
I would just find that to be a project roadblock all the time. All the time.
Yeah, yeah. Another great tip, actually, is to just buy things from eBay. Mm-hmm. So don't look at a picture of a telegram on your screen. Actually order a telegram. They're only about, you can get real old telegrams for a few dollars, like maybe $5-$10.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you can hold it in your hands. You know what the scale of the text is like. You know what the texture of the paper is like. And you also know, if you turn it over, what's going to be printed on the back. Because nobody really scans the backs of things.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Your eBay, that's a perfect idea. I remember needing reference of a tricycle, and for some reason someone thought of going on eBay. Not only did we find one, but it was a mile away and it was like 20 bucks. And so you're right, you get to see everything. You get to see how the paint actually chipped, or the swoop of the fender, or whatever it was. And I think but this Library of Congress thing, I've already bookmarked it. That's great.
Because you can Google all right, vintage, postcard. Right. It's the problem is that I find nowadays is these are all just people that just designed a vintage style card. Right. Like they're not actually authentically old or vintage. They're just titled that. Yeah. So Google search.
I agree. I think the word vintage is really tricky. I never write vintage in Google search.
Or
because
retro.
What you get is retro. Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's better to find things from a very certain period, like I don't know, postcard July 1945, and then work from there.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to talk a little bit about this more recent fake love letter journey of yours?
I would love to get into this.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So I published my book this year, which had the very long, I realize now, title of. Oh God, I can't even remember. It's so long, I can't even remember the title. It's called Fake Love Letters, Forged Telegrams, and Prison Escape Maps: Design and Graphic Props for Filmmaking.
God.
That was published in February, and it was actually published on Valentine's Day, which I thought was a really nice little coincidence because it has the name, has the word Fake Love Letters in the title. So we were going to do a launch in New York in March, in a bookshop on Broadway, and I thought it would be nice if we made a bunch of real fake love letters to hang up in the window for Valentine's Day. But I wanted to approach it the same way that I approach my film prop design, and that is to start with a real reference, because I knew that if I just made up love letters, they would just be so obviously fake. What do people really say when they write a love letter, and what do they really want as a response? So I decided the best way to get some content for this would be to ask on social media if people would be willing to look into the depths of their email archives and dig out old emails to or from their ex or current partners, and then give me permission to turn those emails into physical objects, as if they were props from a kind of mid-century movie or something. Yeah, so it was kind of fun. I wasn't sure if I would get many responses, because I had a quick look in my email archive, and I very quickly was like, oh my God, I can't use anything from this. I couldn't even read it. So I wasn't sure how many people would respond, but I actually got, I got almost 200 responses from people saying, please use this. This is a letter I wrote to somebody a few years ago, or this is a letter somebody sent to me. Everybody gave permission, both the sender and the receiver of the letters that I chose.
Wow.
That's,
I could see getting the sender, but get the receiver be like,
no doubt. But they all probably chose to remain anonymous, right?
They mostly did, yeah. Nearly everybody asked for their names to be changed, except one or two who said it was fine, who actually wanted their real names to be used, because weirdly they were kind of proud of the letters they had sent each other, even though it was utter heartbreak, I think once you get a bit of time and space between these things, maybe you want the world to know about it.
Did you know what time period they were coming to? Were they all rather recent, or did some go way back?
They were all from the last 10, 15 years.
Okay.
So So whenever people had been using email and also still had those email addresses to search for.
Perfect.
Them from. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can read you a couple of them.
Yeah.
I love that. Yes.
Go for it.
Okay. So this first one, Dear Lucy, timing has never quite been my forte. So here I am, confessing something I should have said a long time ago. Lucy, loose, plain Lou. I shan't compare these to a summer's day, all hot and sticky. Rather a day like today, grey, wet, sullen, my most cherished forecast. You are akin to finding a cup of tea I had forgotten about and it still being at a satisfactory temperature. I figured when you moved away would be an apt time to make this confession. Naturally, Daniel.
Wow. That is like poetry. It's so good.
It is. And you're kind of tapping into these other people's worlds, which has to be an amazing project altogether.
Yeah.
I mean, what a great idea.
So what?
It felt like a real privilege to get an insight into other people's love lives, definitely.
What's your process? So like you read this, right? I assume it's just like text on a, email. What's your process of like, I want to bring this to life? What's step one? Are you creating the story? Are you taking little bits in these like pieces that they're writing
keywords
about and contextually bringing it out into like the physical letter that you're making? Or
I had decided on a period for the shop window. I wanted to do a mid-century design. Mm-hmm. And I use the term mid-century very loosely. Like, I'd say mid-century is anything from about 1930 to maybe 1970. I don't know if that's historically accurate, but it just, for me, in terms of graphic design for filmmaking, it means there's a lot of handwriting, cursive handwriting with a fountain pen. There's a lot of typewriters, typewritten notes, typewritten letters, and there's a lot of telegrams. And I love all three of these formats.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided on that period. And for this letter, I did it as a typed note on an old vintage typewriter that I have in my studio. And then I did a couple of telegrams as well. You know, telegrams are things that come up time and time again in a film. Like if you have a film set in the period of the telegram, the director is going to want to put a telegram in because it's such an old form of communication.
Rich. Yeah. It's rich.
It's so iconic.
You know?
Yeah.
That's so neat.
I have a telegram here. I'll read that one to you as well.
Yes. Yes.
I know we've not spoken in years and you're soon to be a married woman, but if you change your mind, just call me. 5 years, 10, 20, it doesn't matter. Wherever you are in the world, I'll come and get you. Andrew.
Wow.
Straight to the point.
No fluff there, right?
Yeah.
Like, wow. And that could, you think about that, that instantly tells me 1920, 1930. Like, right? It almost starts telling the story for you. I love that.
And in reality, this was written about 15 years ago, and it was sent as an email. And the woman who sent it to me said she never contacted him. Because she was getting married to the man that she loved until she saw this project on Instagram and then she contacted him to ask permission to use it in the love letter
Amazing.
Project.
Amazing. And good for him. He's like, definitely. Yeah, that's one of my best words, please.
Did
like,
you
it
find
worked.
That people were just kind of willing to share or would you follow up with secondary questions about after having read the letter for the first time? Like, how did they offer this information? Because that's just so interesting. I mean, what was his response? Was he shocked? Oh my gosh, I forgot that I wrote that to you. How are you doing? Are you considering this? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I did follow up with all of them because they all had content in them that made me want to know more.
Yeah.
So I did ask questions and I did make sure people had permission and I did get some more info on what had gone down in these various relationships. Yeah.
It's such
so
a
cool.
fun project. Like, it's such a uniquely fun project. But
what did you get out of it? Like, what, when it was all, and you got to do a shop and put on display, like, what was the reward?
No, I didn't get to do anything
because
it was on Valentine's Day.
Oh, that's right.
It was on Valentine's Day that I collected all the letters and then I published them on my Instagram. So that was really fun.
Okay.
But then the shop window, which was supposed to be in March, was cancelled.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Instagram thing was fun because I published them all on Valentine's Day. And I did a bit of a build-up to it, and lots of people were saying, this is the first Valentine's Day I've actually been looking forward to, because they were going to get to read all these other love letters. And some of them were really heartbreaking, and some of them were very funny, and there was, I think I made 14 in total. But we never displayed them,
Now, and I'm assuming that cancellation was with respect to COVID, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's, I mean, I'm curious, like, you know, you work in an industry that kind of, I assume, is shut down right now, and it's been sort of slowly maybe coming back. But overall, I mean, the film industry is like kind of just, you know, on pause. And so I'm curious, you know, how, where are you standing? I know that you do a lot, most of your work in this, but are you being forced to sort of pivot, find these other avenues, you know, to either one, make a living, and two, just like find some creative outlets. I'm curious, like, creatives are having to pivot right now, and I'm very curious of how you're handling this.
I mean, the whole film industry just got put on hold, really. I didn't mind too much because I wanted a break. I'd been really, really working on so many different projects all at once, and then everything came to a crashing standstill, and I kind of just made the most of it and made some of my own artwork. Things are picking up again now. I think that one of the weirdest things, though, wasn't not working on a movie. It was that there were no movies released. There was no talk of movies. There was no... It's like movies just completely disappeared. For people who work in the industry, and also people who just, like, go to the cinema. So it'll be nice now. The thing I'm looking forward to most is actually films being released again and getting to go to the movie theater.
I know. Absolutely.
Feel like
everybody is.
it's been ramping it kind of slowly. And I think we're seeing the same, knowing a lot of people in LA and working the business here. I'm hearing them slowly but surely going back. The process is starting because you're right. Not only was it on pause as production, but there was nothing new being released for quite a long time. And you wonder, you know, are people going to get used to, like, how are they going to welcome this stuff back? And I can't wait to, you're right, I can't wait till that happens so we can experience all that again. Even the amount of television production that's rivaling movies, I'm sure, like you were saying, Penny Dreadful and others that are television-based are just as demanding as the film world. If not more, because of the series and the... you talk a lot about continuity. 2 hours is a lot different than a whole season, right?
It's so different. Thank you for saying this, because I've been saying this for years, because, you know, there's a lot of people who just work in TV and a lot of people who just work in film, and I do a little bit of both. And I really think TV is so much harder than film. And our production values now are really high, you know. It's not like the olden days when I started out, like back in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, when everyone who worked in TV really wanted to work in film. Now everybody who works in film wants to work in TV because that's where the audiences are, you know. If you get a call about a new Netflix series, you're on it because you know people are going to see it.
And absolutely, with the stability. The stability is there.
There's stability in working in it as well, because you get a much longer run. So you might work for, I don't know, like 9, 10 months of the year on a TV series. But you also might get asked back for a second season. And there's nothing better than working on the second season of a TV show, because you already have so much research and so much in your back pocket.
The foundation is there.
I always marvel. I think, too, you get like something like Stranger Things is a perfect example of it's in the same category, but they do elevate to a few years later and things do change in the production design. You know, it's getting very 80s now where it used to look very 70s. And so I love seeing that in television stuff. I'm curious, how do you work? Are you independent yourself? Do you have others that are part of your team? And do you come on board with the production? Like, do you work from home? What's that like?
These days I'm independent and I work mostly remotely. I have done for the last couple of years. Before then, I used to go to the location or the studio wherever they were making the film, and I worked within the art department there. But these days I work from my own studio. And I do a little bit on lots of different movies and TV shows.
Did that come more in time because maybe reputation and everything else, now you, it's better to work from your own studio than having to be on location?
Yeah, I just got really lucky, you know. I worked with a couple of really great production designers early on in my career. And then when I decided to start a family, I had my little boy 4 years ago. I wanted to stay in Dublin more and work remotely more. And they were all really willing to make that work, which was great. Because 4 years ago, that wasn't really happening in the film industry, you know. Now, like, remote work is a completely different ballgame. Like, everybody's doing it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't so much like that back then. Usually, you know, back then you really had to be within yelling distance of, like, the prop master or the set decorator. But now we can do it all by email. It's fine.
So creating these pieces, I mean, do you sort of live in, like, the digital realm, and then the prop master might actually create the production of, like, an envelope or a box or something? Or do you have to get in there and silk screen if it's hand done? Or, I mean, is that part of your job as well? Or is it just like mix?
It varies from production to production, really. On some jobs, I will actually make the pieces myself and FedEx them. Like, I did a few pieces for the new West Side Story remake that's coming out soon. Well, I hope it's coming out soon. I don't know when it's coming out, actually. And with that, I actually just FedExed all the pieces from here in Dublin to New York.
That's cool.
I think I only worked on one set for that. It was a street scene, so shopfront signage. And then on other jobs, I might just do everything digitally and send digital files. And then a graphic designer on the other end takes care of all the printing.
The production. Okay.
Such a cool variety you get to mix with, you know?
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it is a good variety. It's fun. Like, I switch kind of all day back and forth between my computer and my drawing board and cutting mat and things. Yeah. I like that.
What do you do? I know you mentioned a little bit something about the difference between fiction and nonfiction, right? Like, I think you were talking about Box Trolls and how it's an imaginary world. It's not a period piece.
Animated, yeah.
Right? But it's not based on, like, 1920s Art Deco, and you can go and research it. So how do you attack something that is almost a make-believe world and come up with these crazy ideas?
Yeah, well, I would actually say that everything we make for a film starts with a real historical reference, even if it's for a completely imaginary world. So even for something like The Box Trolls, which is an animated movie about all these trolls who live under the ground and they wear cardboard boxes for clothes. So, you know, it's a fun premise. But we still started with real references, and everybody on the movie did. You know, the set designers were starting with architecture from the 1300s or whenever. And then we just develop those things. And we do this with the Wes Anderson films as well. You know, we always start with a real piece and we just keep developing it and keep developing it until we turn it into something that works for the script, the plot, the character, the genre. And these things can end up looking quite different. But because they started with something real, it gives them that air of authenticity. And I think that word authentic is quite important, because something that feels authentic is different to something that feels realistic necessarily. Like, we're not hell-bent on realism. Like, you know, we're not sticklers for historical accuracy, and I don't think we have to be.
But in the beginning creative phase for a production like The Box Trolls, there's that teamwork component, right? You're meeting and conceptualizing with other individuals of various roles that have begun drawing and animating, right? To know the overall style approach that you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, sure. And with an animated feature, you know, that process is much longer than on a live action feature, because in animation, you really are creating everything from scratch. And the style is a very carefully designed style. So on The Box Trolls, for example, we hand drew all the graphics. We didn't use a font anywhere in the movie whatsoever.
Oh, wow.
And we also didn't use a ruler anywhere in the artwork. So all the lines in the movie, whether it was a line on a drawing, a graphic drawing, or a piece of set design, a piece of architecture, all the lines were hand-drawn, and the line weight varied in thickness from point to point. Like, basically, we were drawing wobbly lines.
I love it.
But that is a part of the style that is so lovely.
Because it matches the architecture and everything in the set design, right? No straight lines.
And I think it really, it was time consuming, but you do have more time in animation. Because it takes so much longer to shoot, you do have more time to develop a style. And I think like that kind of wobbly line look, it really added to the look of the movie, and it gave everything very, it gave it a lot of energy somehow, because remember, at the end of the day, these are just lumps of clay, you know, in stop motion. But it had a great kinetic energy. And that all came from the production designer.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Well, so
even still, it had to have action.
Yeah.
And like, the logistics is so hard for me to wrap my head around. Because there's so much I assume you have to make for a film, but like,
I know.
Is it something as they hand you a script and like go through and figure out what you need, highlight areas you need for pieces we need? Or is it like, do they send you a brief with a breakdown of every item? Like, is it part of your job to fabricate what you might need for this scene that might not be in the script? Or is someone else kind of like breaking things down? Like, here's the scene, here's a list of items we'll need.
Yeah, so again, that varies from production to production, but sometimes I do my own script breakdown. I read the script and do my own breakdown and figure out what needs to be made for where and when.
Yeah.
And that will include me interpreting something like a scene that says an office scene and has no more details, and I'll know that we need filing cabinets full of documents, we'll need notice boards, we'll need box files, blah, 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 all this stuff. So I'll put those into the script breakdown. And then other times I'll work on a job, like I made a few pieces for the Joker movie last year. And that was all being taken care of in New York. And the art department's coordinator, I think, just literally sent me a list and says, we've got an office scene and we need X many box files and we need so many posters for the walls. And then I just get on with it like that. So it's kind of nice. I like working both ways.
Sure.
They trust you on it.
They know how you're going to fill in the read between the lines, really, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what I mean when I said you need to be within yelling distance of the set decorator, because someone's always going to want to walk into your room and say, I've got another two notice boards to fill. Where's all the paperwork?
Yeah.
But yeah, generally they trust you to get on with it.
No, that's really cool.
Do you recommend to designers looking into this industry? I know I teach and I have a lot of students that the first thing they say is entertainment, 100%, like want to go there. And it could be just an LA thing, but give us just a glimpse of what it's like for you just on a daily basis. I mean, you're doing phenomenal work, and I think it shows in your delivery that you love what you do, but is this something you would like recommend to the young designers?
Sometimes I get letters from people who want to get into graphic design for film, but they're not from a graphic design background, and I definitely recommend an education in graphic design. Like, you really need to know your onions about typography and layout design and all these things, even if you're like working on a movie set in the Middle Ages, you know. And I think sometimes people assume that you don't need to because they're like just props. But certainly I think a graphic design education is way more important than a film education.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to get into the film industry, the best way in is to go in with a craft. And I remember, you know, I did a screenwriting course years and years ago. And I remember at the end of it, someone asked the question, you know, film and the entertainment industry seems like such a closed door. It really feels like there's a lot of nepotism and you really need to know someone who knows someone to get in. And I'll never forget what the teacher said in response. She thought about it for a moment and she said, yeah, I think there is truth in this, but the easiest way to get to know someone is to introduce yourself to them. And if you can introduce yourself to someone in the film industry with a craft, with a portfolio of work, with something that they need, then that's going to be much more valuable to them than being the producer's cousin.
Than having that connection. Yeah, that networking connection.
Yeah, that's really
and so you have that in your experience then, no? You must.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, when I got the job on Grand Budapest Hotel, I hadn't really done a feature film before. I'd done an animated feature and I'd done a few TV shows, but I wasn't like incredibly experienced in
So you
film.
Started on a small independent movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Like the most demanding one. That you've
God.
Done.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
But what I had done was a very small kind of crap TV show about the Titanic, which this was like back in 2010 or something. It actually went straight to Netflix, which at the time was not a good thing. Now it's a good thing to go straight to Netflix, but at the time it wasn't.
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
But because it was about the building of the Titanic, it was set in 1912 and it was full of telegrams and newspapers and posts, letter press posters. And I really threw myself into that job. I made a great portfolio out of that job because I was fascinated by the period and I wanted everything to be brilliant, you know. It doesn't really matter what the script is like at the end of the day. What matters is the work that you create. Mm-hmm. So then when I got a phone call from Wes Anderson's producers looking for a European graphic designer, they really wanted to see examples of telegrams and early 1900s cigarette boxes and things, and I had all of these things in my portfolio, and that's all they needed to see. You know, that's what Wes was looking for. Wow. Like, they weren't looking for somebody who had great connections or networking skills or someone who had worked on 20 different feature films before. Mm-hmm. They just wanted to see the props that were relevant to the period they were.
Then there's no coaching, that training, that's all under your belt already. That makes sense.
Yeah,
and that is just. I don't know. I can't say that's just entirely coincidental. It's just so great that that could be a part of your proposal. I mean, there's bids, there's estimates, and then there's proposals. And we often talk about on the show about proposals and what is that manifesto oomph that makes it that featured grab getting proposal. And you hit it. I mean, you struck gold with that. That's just awesome.
Oh, I struck gold. Absolutely. I mean, there's not a day that doesn't go by that I don't thank my lucky stars for that job. You know, it's absolutely wonderful getting to work with Wes Anderson. You know, I don't think there's a filmmaker who's more beloved, who also has such an interest in graphic design and using graphics as a character in his filmmaking. You know, so it's always a treat.
Wow.
And you had your backup. It's the stars aligned, but you were there with stuff to back it up. And I always think that's like the thing. It's like, it's not luck. It's great timing, but you had something, you know?
Yeah.
How do you put yourself out there? Like, we have a lot of listeners, and I'm sure Adobe Max is going to be tons more young designers. How do you put yourself out there for the work, presenting yourself? I know a lot of times you can't show the stuff that you're working on based on confidentiality or other things or who owns it, let's say. So what advice do you have to the young designer that wants to find that next great job or next client?
Yeah, a lot of work I can't put online at all. And sometimes my workshop students ask me if I think they need like a big Instagram profile. And I think maybe you do in other areas of design. I'm not sure, but I don't think you do in filmmaking. Like, hardly anybody I know who works in filmmaking is on Instagram. That's not how I get hired. Yeah. I don't think I've ever got any film job from being on social media. I get my work by building up my portfolio. And I always tell my workshop students, you know, don't wait for permission. Don't wait for a job offer. Don't wait for a role. You know, you can make your best work now. I know everybody's busy and we've all got day jobs and family life and things, but I think you really have to like take some time to yourself in the evenings to build up a portfolio of work. And you don't need clients. You don't need a brief. You know, you can set your own briefs. I set my workshop students briefs and they have a lot of fun with it. And I think you should make things that you have fun with, you know, and build up a body of work that you can then show to people in film art departments. You know, look at the credits list on any movie. There's going to be a graphic designer listed. If that graphic designer has a website with their email address on it, like, shoot them off an email and say, if you need an extra pair of hands on your next thing, I have got a huge array of work from 1875 which you might be interested in. Yeah, just go for it.
Yeah, which, by the way, I mean, in a way, you're kind of a historian. This is just me on a personal level. I got my first D in history in high school. It intimidates the shit out of me. Oh my gosh. I mean, and you, that has to be a part of your passion as well. I mean.
Well, I don't think the historians on Twitter would call me a historian. I think I, all I do is upset the real historians, unfortunately. But yeah, like I said, we're not sticklers for historical accuracy in filmmaking. We need a little bit of artistic license, you know. Our priority is always the story, yeah. not the history, really. But it does feel like I'm quite lucky to get to delve really deep into certain historical periods. Like, I've definitely learned a lot more about certain periods than I ever would have done if I hadn't worked on shows about them. Like the Tudors, right. Henry VIII. I've done a lot of Victorian TV dramas. I feel like I know way too many facts about horrible Victorian diseases than I should do. But it's fun. I like it. I like learning about different times and places that might not necessarily have crossed my path before.
Yeah, I think that would be very motivating. I think that would just, you know, you're constantly on your feet and there's all these areas that you still need to learn. I mean, it's a part of consulting in a way, right? For the three of us maintaining our independent practices, we oftentimes are the creative consultant, right? Well, if we didn't have the chance to dip into all these different industries, verticals, fields of knowledge and market of the world, I wouldn't know nearly the extent of what I know now. I learned so much from all these different accounts. And that's what keeps me going. Would you guys argue the same? I mean,
oh, 100%.
Similarly for you, if there weren't this range of film from all these different eras, that would be a little dry, perhaps.
We're lucky,
right?
In that way. We get to talk about, so, you know, whatever industries we touch, or in your case, you know, like whatever stories you touch and whatever time periods and history, to me, it makes for such a more vivid career. That's where we're lucky, I think, you know? And I'm like extremely like, just like, I love hearing you talk about this, because I'm like, I'm jealous of that kind of stuff. I would love to do that kind of stuff. It's so interesting. You know, I'm sure you probably get that a lot. And you're just saying, wow, I love my job. But do you see it in that perspective?
Yeah, I definitely see it in that perspective. And, you know, years and years ago, before I made the move to filmmaking, I worked in advertising. And I was a junior designer in an ad agency. And I found that I was doing the same work over and over again, kind of working to templates from my seniors. And I really craved doing something different, and I wanted to be more challenged. And I also felt like I wasn't really very good at design. I don't think I was at that point. I was only like 23. And I decided to move to filmmaking with this idea that I wanted to be challenged every day. And now I am challenged every day.
Maybe a little too much.
And it's really hard work. And that's why I always say to people like, oh yeah, get on the second series of a TV show. It's much easier. You've got everything you need in your back pocket, you know?
Yeah, that template framework is there. And that's understandable. Yeah. Well, you had mentioned that, you know, there's been a little bit of an awakening for us when things started to slow down. You know, granted, they've picked up again, but recognizing that moment of why family's too important, my sleep is too important, I want to appreciate this meal, I want to make the time to make the homemade pie instead of buy it at the store, because that's what I did in March when things got really serious. And now knowing that, you make the time and put your foot down and say, no, I can't reach that timeline.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, I remember at the beginning of the lockdown, there was a little tweet being passed around that said Shakespeare wrote King Lear under quarantine. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I just saw it the other day for the first time. That's interesting. Okay, yeah. It took a while to get over here.
Okay, and you know, I thought that was a lot. I thought that was too much pressure, to be honest. But I do remember having those panicky feelings at the beginning of lockdown, thinking like, well, what am I going to produce with all this time that I'm mm-hmm. going to have on my hands, you know? But two things, like, first of all, Shakespeare probably wasn't required to play Lego for 8 hours a day with his preschooler. And also, I think my feelings about my creative output levels have changed quite dramatically through all this. Because, you know, in my previous life, before March of this year, I used to juggle a lot of creative client work with my prop making work and my own mm-hmm. personal artwork, and also like things like content for social media. And having had a bit of a break, I'm now suspicious that maybe creativity is overrated. Like, it's yeah. okay in moderation. Thank okay. you. Like, okay, we don't need to be creating. Oh, like,
I can breathe now.
Yeah.
Someone really else feels the same.
Yeah. Make some time to make a pie, you know? Like,
yeah.
I'm baking bread.
Right on, Nick.
Hell yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. I love the way you said that. My God.
Yeah, me too. It was great.
So you're giving yourself these freedoms now and these, like, you're right. Like, don't agree to the crazy deadline. Like, maybe there's a way to still do it without saying yes all the time.
Yeah. Say no to more things. Definitely. Yeah. 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 Don't always feel that you have to say like, yes, I can make that work for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can say, actually, that's not going to work for me. I don't know. Like, I'm just thinking out loud.
No,
here.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
I
mean, yes.
That's healthy. And we've talked to a few other creators for this and just like, you know, over the last month. And I think like, if there's one sort of commonality is we were all forced as creatives to like, stop and have a panic when, you know, things are shutting down and like, what's the future going to be like? It forced a pause. And I think through that, a lot of people are coming to this realization of like, shit, I think my workaholism or like it was a little out of, you know, balance, or like,
yeah,
I was putting priority in the wrong perspectives. And like, it's interesting to see creators like take that step back and like be less defined by always having to create something, you know,
yes.
and be defined
yes.
by whatever your output is.
Yes.
Versus like, I want to build some Lego and make a pie. Like, that sounds like a good day, right? And even personally, like, that was something I've had to sort of figure mm-hmm. out and refocus of where I should put those priorities in. And saying no is something I think we all have to start to figure out eventually, and we do, but it is definitely that hurdle of, you know,
yeah.
make it work for you, and also it's okay if you don't put, you know, 10 social media posts out, or if you're not being able to show your work, or, you know, just... I think there's more to that. Yeah, it's an interesting sort of industry uniformity that's happened since COVID. I think everyone's sort of getting that splash of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my mum died at the beginning of the lockdown. She was diagnosed with cancer in early March, and it was quite a quick diagnosis. Yeah.
Wow.
We had 3 weeks together. And she died on the first day that the regulations came into play in the UK.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so that's been difficult this year, you know. But she was a wildlife illustrator. She studied at Goldsmiths in London.
Really?
And when she was younger, she drew every single day. And she always said that good drawing was just practice. You just had to work at it. And one of my favorite sketches of hers is of me when I was 1 day old in the hospital, which we still have in our family home.
I saw this post, and it's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I love it, you know. And so she was drawing in the hospital a day after giving birth, you know. So she was someone who took her artwork pretty seriously in her time, yeah. you could say. Mm-hmm. But you know what? At the end of her life in the hospice, when it was me and my brother and my dad and all her old friends coming in to visit, like, none of us spoke about work or art or yeah. design or creativity or anything like that. Like, all my mum wanted to talk about was funny memories about trips we'd made together or places she'd been with her friends. So it has made me think about, you know, what's really important.
Point taken. Absolutely. Yeah. There's something to be said about that. I mean,
yeah.
Oh, I just saw the picture. It's beautiful.
Isn't it?
Oh
so
my
good?
Gosh. That's really
on
something.
Instagram. It's so good.
And I love that, you know, like that. Do you have, I have a lineage to what my dad and what my mom did as their careers. Do you feel I can't imagine how proud you must feel like there's this thing that you do that your mom did as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, my dad's
creatives share that a lot.
Yeah, my dad's a designer too, so they run a small design practice in North Wales. They make they made information boards for like points of scenic interest. You know?
Cool.
So they make some kind of nice stuff, and it's definitely like a family thing. You know, there was never any question that I was also going to be a designer of some kind, which is really nice. But I also realized like
I could just see it. Annie, you're going to be a designer.
Yeah. but I also realize like what a privilege that is, you know, because I have a lot of workshops.
This has been so wonderful, and we're already. I mean, that this flew by for me, and I knew
they
that
don't
this
have
was
that
going
support,
to happen.
You know, in fact, they face a lot of opposition.
We didn't totally get
into
a
role in
the
design. So whenever I'm at a design conference, like I really try to encourage people to go for it.
Series
because,
that you've made so beautifully.
You know, art is not.
But
like
I do think
the
we will share it with our listeners, and we'll just post
it has this weird reputation of being outside of design circles
because they're quite lovely.
So many jobs.
They're wonderful. And
as a designer,
on top of that,
yeah.
And current.
Yeah, so
this
I
is
really
the life
try to be
living right now. This could be the new norm. So
to get into things, because I was very lucky, you know, to grow up the way I did.
Yeah, and have that support, and also just I think anyone who can find a career in something they're going to do.
Oh well,
of
you know, I actually drew
chosen.
Up that Shakespeare
like
wrote King Lear and a quarantine
like,
quote into a poster
so
for my
better,
my COVID
you know?
Poster series.
So I think that's.
But I don't really
sure.
believe in it. So
yeah.
I also
and we,
made
that's
one
why
as an
that's
90% as an antidote
why we're here
to that, which just says relax.
Of all
your productivity
that,
is not your worth.
A lot of people's telling that story. Same,
and that had been sent in to me by one of my Instagram followers.
It's so wonderful that our industry has changed to something. And there are so many areas and avenues to go into it that it's like it's so robust for anyone to enter. And I always love that, like, I feel like we're the ones that have the happy stories or the great stories to talk about what our day is like, or maybe an issue or something a rewarding moment of our careers. And I don't see that a lot in a lot of other careers or industries, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm just biased to where we're at, but that's how I see it. You know?
Yeah. Probably buying it because it's, I mean, it's filled with gems, true gems.
It's in the cart.
Literally, I'm on Amazon right now.
It's in mine too. I know.
I
locked that in yesterday.
I mean, I'm a sucker for any sort of like reference, fun source stuff to get inspired by. And like, this is just everything that checks my boxes. I think your work is just really, really outstanding stuff.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And honestly, thank you to everybody who's bought my book and who pre-ordered it, because the launch was cancelled, the tour was cancelled, everything was cancelled. But I got some lovely...
We'll definitely link it for sure.
And you know, it got me thinking there may be another time down the line where those love letters will, I mean, if you have them handy still, mm-hmm. I mean, they're still in good shape, right? If they're stored in a safe place, that day may come eventually anyhow.
Yeah, you know? I hope so. I hope that one day we can all travel again and go to exhibitions and
it's just been delayed. Yeah. That's how I'm getting by.
I like that the word pause was mentioned before. That's
this
what
is
it
great.
Is.
We yeah. love talking to people that are just slightly different from where we're at, and it's so good to bring in a cool perspective. Our listeners, and I'm sure tons of people from Madoya Max, are going to get so many good takeaways from this. That was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been very refreshing. And Annie, it's 8 hours ahead for her there at nighttime, and she
trooper
put her little boy down to sleep and was able to step on with us. So that's very much appreciated. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, it looks like it's my bedtime now, actually.
I know. I'm surprised. I mean, you said 8:30, and I'm like, I go to bed when my son goes to bed. I'm spent. Yeah.
She's like, I've already been in bed for 2 hours.
thank you.
No, thank you for having me on. It's been so fun talking to you all.
Likewise. Yeah, I'm looking forward to everything else you got going on and stuff you're going to put out in the future.
Thanks, Annie.
Okay, bye. Good night.
Thank you.